You're listening to Faith for Normal People, the only other God-ordained podcast on the internet.
I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
We have two exciting announcements about God's stories as told by God's children, the children's Bible that we published earlier this year.
Yeah, we are very happy to tell you that God's Stories is officially available internationally now, both through Amazon and through local bookstores, meaning all of you listeners outside the U.S. can order your copy of God's Stories right now.
And for those of you who are in the U.S., God's Stories is currently on sale through Amazon for $22.95 through December 14th. We would love it if you'd pick up a copy no matter where you're listening from, and please let us know what you and your kids think of it by leaving a review wherever you purchase the book. Today on Faith for Normal People, we're talking about the church calendar with Diana Butler Bass.
Diana is an award-winning writer, scholar, and speaker. Most importantly, she's been on a podcast before called The Bible for Normal People.
Yes.
But she's the author of 12 books, the most recent of which is A Beautiful Year. You can also follow her on her wildly popular Substack at dianabutlerbass.substack.com.
And don't forget to stay tuned at the end of the episode for Quiet Time, where we'll reflect on the conversation. All right? Let's dive in. You ready?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
We're carrying around this 2,000-year-old calendar that still shapes our imaginations, and it's based on imperialism, militarism, and a transactional economic system. And so the Christian calendar sort of can slam into that calendar and acts as a corrective, if we let it.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem, mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
Diana, welcome back to the podcast. It's great to have you.
It is great to see you, Pete, and Jared, too.
All right. Well, we're here to talk about the church calendar and why it matters. And, you know, you've written a devotional based on the church calendar here. So why should people care about the calendar? Right before we jumped on, I was talking about, I think a lot of our audience, like me, grew up feeling like the church calendar was too rigid or was part of this tradition and liturgy, and we were supposed to kind of do away with that. But I think for a lot of folks, as we feel more ungrounded or unmoored from like a conservative or more evangelical tradition, we're looking for something to sort of ground us. And so, you know, make a case for why the church calendar can help with that.
Yeah, the church calendar, I get what you're saying, because I grew up United Methodist. So when I was a little kid, I was in Methodist church, and there was some familiarity with the church calendar there in my childhood. But then when I was a teenager, I joined an evangelical church. And in the 1970s, oh, I can't believe it's so long ago, but there was a real sort of move towards anything that smacked of ritual. Mm-hmm. You know, the ritual was like the established church, and the ritual was boring, and the ritual disconnected you from God. It wasn't something that functioned in a way that would bring you close, you could have an experience of God. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people left ritual behind. But eventually, for me at least, I came back into a more mainline, more traditional setting when I was in my early mid-20s and became an Episcopalian. And so for most of my adult life, I've been in some sort of faith setting where the calendar has been followed. And frequently people ask me, you know, why it is I'm still a Christian after all these years, even knowing all the terrible things I know about Christianity and its history and how it's involved in politics. And one of the things that's really held me to the faith is this alternative sense of time that has been built into my very being from following the church calendar. And this rhythm of seasons through the year has made me more attentive to the stories of faith and taken me to places. It's literally taken me to places I never expected that I could go theologically and in terms of community and also in terms of activism. Mm-hmm. And so it's basically a spiritual practice that's very ancient and yet is still sort of part of everyday churches. And the churches that do follow it, I'm not entirely sure they always understand the radicalness of it. Mm-hmm. So in effect, this book was a call to recover the depth, the spiritual intensity, and that radicalness for people who already are in churches where this may be followed, and certainly for people who have left religion behind or who still might be Christian but are uncomfortable in more conventional religious settings. It's a way to live the story without necessarily having to be in a building. Mm-hmm. The Christian year is a portable practice, as it were.
Yeah, right. You know, I'm thinking of, again, people for whom this might be very new. You know, I've been Episcopalian now for about 15 years. I made that jump a while back because I got tired of 45-minute sermons. I needed a 12-minute homily and Eucharist where you go up and do it, right? So anyway, give us the stages of the liturgical year. When does it begin? Does it begin in January? No, it doesn't, right? So just the basic stages so people can maybe, who are just totally fresh to this, might have a sense of what's going on.
Yeah, the calendar begins with Advent. And the beginning of Advent is coming up on us as we're taping, but when this airs, I think we'll be right smack at the start of Advent. And it's usually around December 1st. It's the first Sunday. Generally, it's the first Sunday after what we celebrate in the United States as Thanksgiving. And that Advent goes for 4 weeks, and then we're at Christmas. Christmas is a 12-day season that is actually after December 25th. And then there's a season called Epiphany, which is in January and most of February. You move from Epiphany to Lent, and Lent ends with a special week called Holy Week. And anybody that's ever around Roman Catholics or Roman Catholic family will be well aware of that. And Holy Week leads to Easter. Easter is a 50-day season, not a single Sunday. And then you're in the final season of the year, which is called Pentecost or Ordinary Time. So that means that the Christian calendar has six seasons, not four. And it begins around December 1st and it ends around November 30th or so. Mm-hmm. The very last day of the Christian calendar, very last Sunday of the Christian calendar, is a feast called the Feast of Christ the King, which is an absolutely fascinating way to end the year. And I think it's a very compelling festival in a year where people are in the streets protesting no kings.
Is that happening?
So we can talk about that.
Yeah.
Well, but maybe, I mean, I think that's I want to make sure we get back to that. But to set that up, you kind of just went through, which was very helpful. Thank you for kind of taking us through that. But something you said earlier, and is in your book, you're framing this as the Christian year could be translated as story as well. And so before we get to the parts of the story, can you just describe what you mean by that? Like, how do we get into the story aspect of something that can maybe feels mundane to folks?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the problems with ritual is people think that it's simply structure. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with structure. I think that we as human beings often benefit from some level of structure that is outside of us. Structure can hold us to account for certain things, the ways that we behave. And also for me, I can go off on tangents pretty easily. And so structure helps me focus. So there's nothing bad about structure, but structure can be seen as kind of nuts and bolts, kind of dull. But the truth of it is, and I think that you two might really get this, is that I primarily think of myself as a writer. And writers approach work in different ways. And the way that a book comes to me is that at first I get an idea and it's like, oh, that's a really good idea. Human beings get ideas all the time. Well, what makes an idea into a beautiful article or an essay or a book? And that is, for me at least, once I have an idea, I have to think of what's the structure of this? What form is it going to take? And I've written 12 books now. This is actually my rounds out the dozen. So every book for me has behind it this sort of architecture of a design that is the structure. So that to me is what the Christian year is like. A Christian year is like the branches on a tree in the winter time. And if you just look at the branches on a tree in the winter time, it looks pretty stark. But what you don't realize is that that's just the organic shape of the stripped down thing. That's the structure of the tree. You're looking at the barest possible minimum of the structure of the tree. But then, you know, it flowers out, it leafs out, it becomes something different. Birds sit in it in the springtime. And, you know, people go under it to have picnics in the summer and leaves turn in the fall. And so there's an entire story, a storied world that goes around that tree, which at its simplest form, it's just a bunch of branches on a trunk.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what liturgy and that's what the Christian year, this Christian calendar is.
Mm-hmm.
It can be the barest form, but if you go all around all of the seasons, you see that it fills out and that it becomes a storied world. And so it's about far more than just the structure of the thing. It becomes about all of the beauty and the storms and the leaves and the people who gather under its branches and all everything that is associated with it. And so I can never separate structure and story. To mm-hmm. me, that's an absolute necessary part of the kind of craft that I work on all the time as a writer.
Mm-hmm. So The church year then is, there's a story, right? Right. Mm-hmm. So just what is the story that it's telling? What is the story? And feel free to contrast it with other stories that are told that we live our lives by.
It's hard when you want me to tell a story of an entire year. And I just told you I'm very distractible.
Well, so am I. So go ahead.
I know this is going to be a real treat for everybody.
To people in their 60s with ADD or something, or whatever we have. Anyway, yeah.
Yep.
So, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What I'm looking for is what's the power of this story that liturgical year is trying to get at, right? What is it? What can people look at and say, okay, that's different than what I'm used to, than the world and the way I keep time typically. This is different.
I think that one of the most interesting things about the calendar is that what we would consider the end of the story is in the middle.
Mm.
And that is, if you were just going to write a story about the life of Jesus and how God deals with the world in the frameworks that were presented in the New Testament, you would say, well, Jesus was born, and then Jesus lived, he taught a bunch of stuff, and then all this nasty stuff happened, and he died and was raised from the dead. Period. End of story. But that's not how the Christian year works. The Christian year puts that piece that we think is the big dramatic finale, the Easter story, the resurrection, trumpets, the whole thing, puts that smack in the middle of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a different rendering of time. If you're writing a story where the end is in the middle, because what it means is everything before the big reveal, it sort of moves from the edges toward the middle. And then you see the heart of the story. And guess what happens then? You move back out toward the edges. And so it's a time in the Christian narrative pulsates in really kind of almost a circular way, in curves and spirals and switchbacks. And it does not move in a straight line from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And this is what I think is really intriguing, because in Western thought, we're sort of brainwashed in this idea of linear time, that time has a beginning and a middle and an end. And so we've taken sort of Western frameworks of time and we often plop them on top of the Bible. And when we do that, it creates all kinds of mess, because I can think of the sort of the two biggest sort of Protestant families of theology in the 20th century. One would have been liberal or progressive theology. And that's exactly what liberals and progressives did. They took a linear time frame and they plopped it down in the Bible. And they said that human beings are good and we're getting better and we're moving toward the kingdom of God. And all we have to do is enact what Jesus taught and the world will get better and better. And the kingdom of God will arrive here in the world, particularly in America. And then fundamentalists went kind of the other way with their timeline. And they said, yes, there is a timeline. And God divides time up into seven stages. And we're right at the end of history. And pretty soon there's going to be this thing called the rapture. And then there's going to be the apocalypse and all of time will wrap up and there's going to be a judgment. And I've been in both of those kinds of churches where you have this linear sense of time imposed on the Bible stories. And then the Bible kind of becomes, in effect, almost crammed into a philosophical sense of time. But in the Christian year, I think it's much closer, this sort of circular or curved sense of time, the pulses of time. I think it's much closer to the kind of near Middle East mindset of the ancient world that would have been native, in effect, to Judaism, and certainly closer to the kind of way that Jesus himself thought about the nature of time. Mm-hmm. So I think that the Christian year takes us back to an older sense of time and history.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knete ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Ein Barra ist der irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 Gigabyte für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee, das wäre auch schön blöd.
Le
Barra, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter lebara.de.
How do we, this is getting philosophical, I do want to come back to some of these very practical ways that, to your first question, Pete, around the story that it's telling and how is that different than the story we're often given. But before we do that, how do you help people? Because my family background is, my family's Choctaw. And so as I got older, started being smacked in the face with this Western view of time versus a native view of time. And I went through this transition phase where when you let go of linear time, you can almost feel like then things feel meaningless, because along with a linear sense of time is also a sense of purpose, right? That liberal sense is like we're moving toward progress and we're heading to an end. And then the conservative, even if it's toward destruction, at least we're headed toward some end. And then when you start to shift your thinking of time, sometimes it can kind of despair, like, oh, this pulsating thing is just a never-ending back and forth. How have you managed that to bring purpose and to bring meaning? How has that become an exciting thing for you rather than a, oh, bummer, we're just like more circular or more in, out, like, oh my gosh, we're just keep going round and round on this merry-go-round here.
You know, that's kind of the complaint that Western Christianity has sometimes had about Eastern religions, is that there's the sense of time, because they are less linear and more into repeating cycles of life and time and, you know, creation, all those things, that it can be a despairing kind of wheel, just sort of turning through the universe, and it never goes anywhere, as it were. I think that that's a really kind of, I think that's a really false concept. And it's certainly not the concept that the Bible is trying to communicate. Because I don't think that the way that the Christian year works is it is cyclical, but it's, and it does rehearse. I would say it rehearses the same things over and over again, but it never really repeats them in exactly the same way. Sure, you celebrate Christmas every year on December 25th. But what happens is that since human experience is building and changing all around all the time, when you encounter these holidays sort of anew and these seasons anew, they speak differently, because we as human beings are in a different place than we were 12 months earlier when the wheel turned toward Advent, what have you. And so there's this mixture of human experience going into the cycles and us getting older, and our whole, you know, every what that entails as far as we as human beings are alive, that isn't really so much a circle as it is more like a spiral. Or so it does move, it does have directionality,
right?
But the directionality isn't just beginning, middle, and end. And I think that we don't pay enough attention to the downsides of linear history, because the real downside of linear history is that, yes, we are moving towards a purposeful ending, but the question is always, well, who is in control of that purposeful ending? Who are the heroes of the story? Who are the victors at the end of the story? And so what linear history also does is it also, of necessity, creates human beings who want to be in power and in control of the line of history itself. And to me, that become that becomes an incredibly dangerous. That's the dangerous downside of linear history. There have to be people who are the bad people in the story, and the people who want to win the story have to defeat the evildoers. It is absolutely part of the story.
Yeah. And I mean, that sort of ties into a couple of things I was hoping we could talk about. You know, the disillusionment with Christianity in our country today, I think it's palpable. And with the rather unholy alliance with political power and things like that. So what can the ritual of a liturgical year, how can it give people a sense of a different kind of grounding and maybe some, I'm going to say like a sense of transcendence, even that, that isn't just locked into the day to day and the corruption and all that stuff that we're so tired of.
Yeah. Well, I think that the year itself unfolds those possibilities as it plays itself out against sort of the political and social year that we experience through our calendars and through the ways in which our world, the world of the 21st century is largely structured. At the beginning of a beautiful year, I talk about how the Roman calendar, this 2,000-year-old linear calendar, is still the sort of functional base of the calendar that the world runs its imagination by in the 21st century. And so here we have a calendar that begins at the in January and ends with December, the 12th month. Every month of the year that we have is named after a Roman emperor, a Roman god, a Roman festival, or a Roman number. And so I can remember the day that I was just kind of playing with this in my mind's eye, and it was the summertime. And here we were in July, and we were celebrating the 4th of July, American Independence and Freedom, on a day named after Julius Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, well, this is odd. You know, if you stop to think about it, we're celebrating liberty and independence on a day named after one of the worst of all Roman emperors. Maybe we should have changed the name of the month 250 years ago. Maybe July should be called the month of Thomas Jefferson, you know, or something like that,
right,
rather than Julius Caesar. So this is kind of the contrast of our calendars, is that we're carrying around this 2,000-year-old calendar that still shapes our imaginations, and it's based on imperialism, militarism, and a transactional economic system.
Mm-hmm.
And all of and if you look at the holidays that we celebrate in the United States, probably 3/4 of them follow that pattern. They still follow that same sort of pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the actual Latin names, and we have Latin background names for half of the days of our weeks. And we still are celebrating mostly military heroes and military events. We're celebrating imperialism, people who have had a powerful impact on politics and sort of the way that society is designed. And we're celebrating economic transactionalism. And mm-hmm. many of our newer holidays are just outright economic holidays, Black Friday,
right,
Amazon Prime Days, bank holidays, those kinds of things. So basically, I mean, what I'm saying is that the calendar that we currently have is telling us a story, but we never notice it. And so the Christian calendar sort of can slam into that calendar and acts as a corrective, if we let it, in our lives and our communities and our imaginations.
And by not using the names of the months, you know, it's like, it's the first Sunday of Advent, the second Sunday of Advent, yeah, you know, the fourth week of ordinary time. I mean, it's a whole different way of thinking about the thing that's always in the backdrop of our existence. But we never think about it. We never analyze it. We never try to understand, as you're doing in your book and here today, the impact of that on how we do humanity.
There's this one thing that I think we all can talk about just from our own experience, is that over the lifetime of the three of us, an entire season of the church got co-opted by consumerism.
And no.
That I know is a terrible
thing. Did that happen? I didn't notice. Anyway, go ahead.
And yes, did that really happen? And what it is, you know, people often say that, oh, I hate commercial Christmas. But the truth of it is it's even worse than most people think, because the 12 days of Christmas are 12 days of merriment after Christmas. And they're literally dedicated to being with families, giving away money to the poor, sharing gifts, feasting, having huge parties. I mean, it's literally supposed to be sort of the most festive and joyous time of the year. And it was considered to be a time of sort of freedom from inhibition. I mean, it was just a great, great period in the church season. And what happened is commercial interests took the 12 days of Christmas, put them before Christmas, and turn them into sort of the end of Advent, if they pay attention to Advent,
yeah,
as the 12 shopping days before Christmas. And so they say, oh, here we are, we're counting down the 12 days of Christmas. And every time that happens, I go, no, you're not. You're counting down the 12 shopping days before a holiday in which you're going to close your stores for maybe 24 hours, if we're lucky, before you open them again on the day after that special mm-hmm. December 25th day, to big sales and people pouring back into your stores and scooping up anything that's left on the shelves. And so we've literally seen a traditional Christian practice taken and put in service to specific consumerist period of time, and turned into something it just isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's pretty ugly.
Yeah.
What are some practical ways that we can keep Christ in Christmas. That's what I want to say.
Wow. Like, how wow. do we? I did not wake up this morning thinking Jared would say that. But go for it. Go for it, Jared.
You know, how do we? It just feels like, I think for a lot of these things, sometimes the wheel of these transactional economics, the wheel of these things feels so heavy and they feel so it's right. like, what am I going to do?
Inescapable.
And it feels a little bit like, am I going to just not go to work the next day and be like, well, I don't operate by this calendar. Like, how do we, that feels lonely and it feels like you're going to be out of a job. So how do we resist kind of the pull that feels like it has sucked up so much of our culture now?
Well, I think I feel the same tension. Oh my gosh. You know, the weeks before Christmas, I don't know how men experience the weeks before Christmas, but many American women, especially middle-class women, mm-hmm. and here it doesn't matter if you're white, black, Hispanic, your race does not really count here, but women feel enormous pressure around Christmas time to make like the perfect Christmas. And whatever the perfect Christmas is in your tradition, it's like, that's your business in those 4 weeks before Christmas, is to create this perfect environment so that your family will have great memories going forth forever and ever. And they're not going to be mad at you at anything about anything from your childhood. And so your kids will love you. So the pressure of that is terrifying.
Yeah.
And when it comes to Advent, I think I succumbed to it at some earlier points in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm just more low key about it. And if things don't get done, that's mm-hmm. just too bad. Mm-hmm. Christmas is going to come anyway.
Right.
And so I make purposeful decisions like that. And I also do along the season, I try not to think, oh, I've got to get it all out of the box on the first day of December so that we have everything perfect for the whole of the month. I literally build kind of through the month with decorations. I mm-hmm. sort of start one place of the house and then I kind of build out with different things so I don't get too exhausted, so I don't feel like I have to look like Architectural Digest on the very first day of December.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, I make it kind of a month-long unfurling.
Yeah.
And we also do the home, religious ritual of lighting candles on an Advent wreath.
Right, right.
And so we slow it down. We make decisions that take us out of the normal course of things. And we look at what's really important.
Mm-hmm.
About the season.
You know, I appreciate that. I was thinking of my mother, right? And other women I know who they have that same pressure. And maybe finding pockets of quietness, and you know, maybe they can't go away for a few days, but maybe they can. Mm-hmm. I'm just not going to do that this Saturday. I'm going to restore some sanity into my life to try to regain something of that rhythm of the year, you know. And it's hard for people to do that, though. It's hard for me to do that. Yeah, and
if I can, my wife has this for sure, and we've talked about it. And so I also don't want to always put that on the women. I think there's cultural pressure. And if you're in that, you also feel caught because it's like, well, now I have been complicit. I've kind of created this, and now there are expectations, and I may get into, you know, my kids may be upset with me. So I also think for men out there, it's also our job to reinforce that this is not mom's job. These are the expectations. Like, we can do a better job too of not saying,
right,
you know, women, you need to just figure this out and not do it. And you know, to hell with the consequences. Like, well, there are real consequences sometimes when, you know, the teacher doesn't get the present, and it's up to the mom to make sure all the teachers get all the presents. Right. And mm-hmm. so I think there's also a place. Sometimes I think it's easy for men to be like, well, why are you doing that? Just don't do it. Instead of just, how about we help maybe slow down these expectations over time mm-hmm. and be in it together? So,
Yeah. Well, maybe it will help that I happen to be a woman and I just said, slow down.
Yeah.
Don't worry if things don't get done.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Yes. Yes.
And, you know, it was interesting to me because when I wrote the essays on Advent, the whole section is about time. And then there's also stuff that weaves in and out. about family traditions. And I think that my very favorite essay in that entire section is called Blue Christmas. And it's about a memory of my father that took place before Christmas when I was probably 6 or 7 years old. And I tell the story about how my parents every single year, I mean, and my dad was a florist.
Wow.
So talk about high expectations of what a house would look like.
Gosh.
I mean, literally, I'm like a professional.
Yeah.
Because I grew up with a professional. People would pay my dad to come and design their homes for Christmas. And so this is what one of the things my father did. And that meant that our house usually looked pretty good, you know, at Christmas. But every single year, my parents would have the same exact fight when I was really small. I grew up in the 1960s. And so everything was modern. Mm-hmm. In the 1960s. So when I was real small, we had a silver Christmas tree. We were like the people that Charlie Brown hated in Charlie Brown Christmas. We had the fake Christmas tree. And my dad decorated everything in blue.
Mm-hmm.
And now my mom, she actually hated all the modern stuff. She hated the blue. She hated the silver tree, the whole thing. And so they would always fight about this. And finally, my mom got my dad to have a green plastic Christmas tree instead of a silver metallic Christmas tree. That was a big advance in our house. Mm-hmm. And then my mother she started nagging him about the lights. And she said, I don't want blue. I don't want blue. Blue's horrible. Why would you put up blue Christmas lights? She wanted white lights.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because my family is pretty working class, and my mom thought white lights were what rich people had on their houses.
Gosh.
Yep. So my mom wanted the status of these white lights on her house. Mm-hmm. And so she went, white lights, white lights. And then she got nowhere with white. And finally she said, well, what about colored lights? The children like the colors of Christmas. And my dad just, nope, blue lights. And so there's this memory that I have of being a little girl and going outside on a winter night and helping my dad put up the blue Christmas lights.
Mm-hmm.
And he would line the roof and the bushes, and he did it so artistically. It was just his placement was perfect, you know. Yeah. And finally, this one night, we were out there and he looked at it and I said, Daddy, why do we have blue lights in our house? And he said, he took my hand, and it had started about 10 minutes before this, just to really lightly snow.
Okay.
And he said, he looked at me and he said, because they're pretty when it snows. And I looked at the lights, and my dad was right. And there was some way in which that blue light coming through those frosty white snowflakes, it taught me something about Christmas, and it taught me something about beauty, and it taught me about how a father loves his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
That had nothing to do with the decorations per se, or getting it all right.
Right, right.
Mm-mm-mm. You know? And those are the things that we remember.
Right.
About the year and how the year unfolds. And so that essay, Blue Christmas, I use as an example of how a lot of churches recently have started to have blue Christmas services. And instead of having it right around the longest night, usually December 21st or 22nd, inviting people into the church simply to reflect on what's been hard. In the previous year.
Oh, right, right.
Yep. Which we don't leave a lot of room for in a consumerist society. It's not supposed to be that way, right? So, yeah.
Right. And I think that the story of my dad really sort of cuts against the grain of that consumerism. You know, I mean, it is about decorations. It is about the kinds of things we do during the holidays. But the memory isn't a bought one in a package.
Right.
The memory is the physicality of my dad's hand and the snow falling. and just the sheer beauty of the season, which takes me immediately back to that. Mm-hmm. And then causes me to ask the questions, you know, what do I want my daughter to remember about me at Christmas when mm-hmm. she's recalling her life?
Yeah.
Some 10 or 15 or 20 years from now.
Right. I think we have time for one more question.
Yeah.
And I'm really curious about this. And maybe you can send us off with this, right? So much of the church year is ordinary time. What's the power of ordinary time? What's the significance? It's like ordinary. Oh, let's wait for Advent, that kind of thing. You know, what's the power of ordinary? Because that's where we live most of our lives, I think, you know, yeah. in that ordinary time. So just maybe send us off with a few words about ordinary time.
Well, in some senses, it's easy. The first half of the Christian year is about the life of Jesus. And so that's the part that goes from the edges, the waiting in Advent through Christmas, the birth in the manger, the 12 days of merriment, Epiphany, Lent, Holy Week, Easter, boom, resurrection, the big explosion, the big bang in the center of the circle, as it were. But then what happens next? Well, you have to go out. And that's the second half of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The first half is about moving toward the center of God's dream for us in the embodiment of Jesus. And then the second half, after the big explosion of the surprise of the story, we carry it out back to the edges. And the second half of the Christian year is about us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about how well we listened to the things that Jesus taught and how we respond to Jesus' central call to love God and love our neighbors as ourselves. And so in the second half of the year, you hear all of the great parables of Jesus and the questions mount, you know, mm-hmm. am I the Good Samaritan? What happens when I enact the role of the older brother in the parable of the prodigal son, or am I the prodigal daughter that needs to come home? What do these stories mean in the world in which we're living today? What does it mean to live in a story where there's this constant reversal of hierarchy, where the first shall be last and the last shall be first? How do we actually embrace a social vision of blessed are the poor, blessed are the mourning, blessed are those who are persecuted? What does that mean for us now? And how do we live it in our world? And that's what the second half of the year is. It's this quest through the teachings, the stories, the healings, and saying, is all this only about 2,000 years ago, or is this about us? How does that big moment in the center radiate outward through our lives, our communities, and into the world? And that's ordinary time. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to take an extraordinary story into the heartbeat of our days mm-hmm. in the second half of the year.
Well, Diana, thank you so much for jumping on. You've done what I didn't think anyone could do, and that's make the calendar so compelling and so rich. And I say that as someone grew up in that tradition that said, ritual's bad, let's get rid of it. You've just really kind of illuminated the power of the calendar. So thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it.
Oh, it's great. You all take the Bible and do the same thing all the time. So I'm just following your lead and trying to make ritual more interesting to people as well as the scriptures themselves.
Great. Well, thanks, Dan.
And now for Quiet Time
with Pete and Jared. All right. Well, here we are, Quiet Time, talking about the church calendar. And so, Jared, did you have any exposure to it at some point in your life?
No, again, it was
ever.
It was mostly yes, but we had like the evangelical version, just like we had our own version of like rap, and there's like we have like the evangelical version of everything. So outwardly, we said no to the church calendar. It's all ritual. It's dead tradition. Not helpful. But we would have like Lent was a time to like give up something, you know, okay. So if you gave up chocolate, you were like a better Christian or mm-hmm. something like that. And then instead of, well, not instead of, I guess in addition to Christmassy stuff, we'd like make Jesus a birthday cake or something.
Okay.
That was like the extent of the church calendar, but nothing, Epiphany wasn't a thing. The Pentecost wouldn't have been a thing, nothing like that.
Well, I mean, it's Christmas, which includes Advent. Yeah. It's all one, a blob of Christmas.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And then Easter, and then VBS.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we would have celebrated Easter, but not in any, again, yeah. It's like the one day, the but one
it's,
event.
It's those are the two holidays.
Yes.
You know, and of, there's right. an acknowledgement of maybe of other things, and maybe Lent, because you feel sort of guilty, you should give something up. Yeah. So that gets a little bit of traction, but after that, it's just not much.
Yeah, what about you? Because you didn't grow up evangelical, so you might have more exposure to church calendars.
Yeah, stuff. I mean, my first church experience was in Lutheran church, where robes and all that kind of stuff. And so I remember the colors changing in church at Christmas time, you know, mm-hmm. all that stuff. And so I had that, and but then I didn't. You know, I had a conversion experience in a Nazarene church when I was like 15, and then it was like no liturgy, anything, church, no consciousness of church calendar. Until really like my late 40s, maybe around 50. And I just started thinking to myself, I'm bored out of my mind in church, mm-hmm. you know, and it's really not against the people or anything like that. It just, I don't want 45 minute sermons. I want some sense of, and this came out in the interview a little bit, some sense of transcendence that's beyond my day to day. And that's where, you know, now having been a part of, the Episcopal world for, I guess, about maybe 13 years now, 14 years. I like that. I like the regularity. I like doing things on a Sunday that other people are also doing whenever their Sunday morning is, you know, wherever they are in the world, and being a part of that and watching the rector's robes change, you know, over the year. It's nice because it reminds me of something, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, when related to this, when my son was relatively young, he was about 16 years old, and we were at a church that was, you know, more evangelical and all kind of stuff, and you know, the music was trying to draw the young people in, kind of thing. And he said, and he wasn't really particularly religious. He just said, I don't want the kind of music I hear all week to be in church. Mm-hmm. It should be something else. And he sensed that. And that's what I've gotten out of trying to observe in some sense, the liturgical calendar. There are calendars you can buy that start in December.
Oh, interesting.
With Advent, and they go, and like ordinary times, like this huge page.
it just unravels down.
You know? Yeah. And you know, Holy Week is like, it's a little thing. It's like, wow. But that's it. But it's unsettling to mm-hmm. have a calendar like that. It's like that. What I have to sort of convert that into my currency.
Yeah, right.
Which is the
right.
secular calendar.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good segue, I think, because one of the things we wanted to talk about here was more of this idea of the calendar we have, the quote secular calendar, is based on these ideas of imperialism, militarism, kind of this consumeristic or transactional economic system, and this idea of resistance to that. That really struck a chord with me. Mm-hmm. I think it was
me too. Yeah.
Not something I've given a lot of thought to, of how we are shaped by these forces that we just assume are more objective, I think, mm-hmm. than they are. And we think that they're more neutral.
Right.
It's like, well, it's just the names of the month. Let's not get carried away. Let's not read into this. Yeah. But, you know, talking about Christmas and highlighting the more extreme examples uh-huh. shows you how it's kind of penetrated a lot of different things.
It's baked in, I think. You know, that's right. just it. And, you know, transactional, militaristic, you know, imperialistic. It's, we live in that and we don't notice. We don't notice the myths that we live by,
right?
That give meaning to everything. That underlying mm-hmm. structure, we're not even aware that it's there. And the notion of being awakened from that, you know, is it's very appealing to me, honestly. And mm-hmm. but you know, you made the point, and it's a good point. Like, well, how do you actually do that?
Right,
right? Because you still have to go to work, you know, and you've got off the week between Christmas and New Year's, and you know, you're not any time before that, and and everybody's having these parties, and how do you do that? And that's, you know, I mean, not to get weird Book of Revelation on us here, but like, you know, the mark of the beast, you can't buy or sell without a certain way of looking at the nature of reality,
right.
And interpreting that symbolically, which we should.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's like, yeah, we are sort of trapped in a way.
Right.
You know, it's like not buying from Amazon. Yeah, but I need it tomorrow and I don't want to go out. You know, it's like, it's how do you live in an alternate time when every aspect of your life is governed by that other way of thinking at the time.
Yeah.
And it's not helpful. It's destructive to people. It's dehumanizing.
Right.
It sort of sucks. I mean, so what do you do? Jared, fix it.
Yeah, that's why I asked. I hope Diana was going to give us the answer. Diana, you didn't give us the answer. But I mean, I think it's finding these little ways, because my hope would be that it snowballs over time. And I do think there are times when the resistance is going to cost us something, you know, like not shopping at Amazon or things like that. Like that just costs us something. And I think that's what we often don't want to do, is we want to figure out a way to make change without it costing us anything.
Right, yeah.
But I think that, you know, one thing that came to mind was the move from celebrating Christopher Columbus Day to having it be more of a Native American day, which I don't usually care about kind of token things like that. But I actually appreciate that, because over time, that is kind of helps us think about it a little bit differently. It's interesting, because I'd be curious if this is maybe an age thing or a perspective thing, but I think of these words of imperialism, militarism, and transactional economics, I think you resonate with that. It sounded like you resonate with that. And Diana, I think for me, the more I think about it, I actually am a little bit more worried about the loss of any meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Because growing up, I didn't know the difference between Memorial Day and Veterans Day. Like I didn't practice any of these holidays as anything meaningful.
Right.
It was a day off of school.
Right.
And that almost scares me more, is that like we're not adhering to the meaning of the days. I get that they are built on these.
Mm-hmm.
It's that I think they've been kind of stripped of any meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And the question for me is, how do we re-enchant our days? How do we have them mean something again?
Right.
And my hope would be, let's make them mean something that's a little bit more life-giving and not death-dealing.
Right.
But there's that, and maybe that's part of the answer, is maybe it's because these narratives, this imperialism, militarism, transactional economics, don't compel us the way that they did maybe in the 60s or 50s or 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've just lost touch with them, and we need something to replace them. And I wonder, that's more energizing for me, is how do we replace them, maybe not even as resistance, but as resistance to apathy and meaninglessness.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a big task. And I know, you know, Tom Wright talks about a renewed sense of transcendence and spirituality, which is sort of like the road that's been paved over everything and made it all just macadam. It's cracking.
Yeah.
And you've got these little plants that are coming up again, you know? And in my opinion, I think people are getting tired of the apathy. I think they want meaning, but the current structure that we have does not provide them that meaning. And people, I think good, normal people see through the transactional issues, the militaristic issues, the imperialistic issues, and they're looking for something. They're looking for some alternative way to live. And younger people especially, you know, my kids are all in their 30s and they don't think the way I did when I was in my 30s. It's a whole different world.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, I'm proud of them. They're actually trying to think through, how do I exist well?
Right.
And a way that's hopeful, that's life affirming and meaningful, and not, you know, rooted in, I guess, the polarization that we're in now, that may be a direct result of the myths that we've been telling ourselves for so long.
I think part of the meaning making part of this, and even the resistance part of this, is it takes time and energy and community, to your point. It's exhausting to go it alone. Like, what am I going to do if I have to go to work and these things? Right. But as a community, it takes time and energy to reflect on it. Like, the idea that I grew up with, that ritual is vacuous, can be true if you don't put energy into it.
Right.
If you don't put imagination into it. And so it's not just about practicing different holidays in some hollow way, but it is taking the time and the energy to reimagine what these things mean for us.
It takes effort. I mean, spiritual disciplines, they call it, I think, right? And that's part of it.
And I think I'm excited about how the calendar can shape the energy and the mood and the tone of have that whole wheel of emotions that people go through the calendar, so that this is the time for that. And we make sure, you mentioned grieving and how we don't have a time with the Blue Christmas.
Right.
It's like, well, where's the time when we do that, so that we know, I think the Jewish calendar does this better, like with Yom Kippur and these other places where this is the time to grieve. Now get it all out. If you've been so busy and you haven't been thinking about it, we have a time marked for that. And I think that is a really, that energizes me to think about it a little differently, because it's actually helping me be human.
Right. Reclaiming our humanity from the structures that are not helpful to us.
And using the calendar to remind us and propel us toward that.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's do more of that.
Let's get on that right away.
Yeah. Sounds good. Well, thanks to everyone who supports the show. If you want to support what we do, there are three ways you can do it. One, if you just want to give a little money, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/give.
And if you want to support us and want access to our library of over 50 classes, plus bonus episodes, an ad-free podcast feed, and a thoughtful community of people asking tough questions about the Bible and faith, you can become a member of our online community, the Society of Normal People, at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join.
And lastly, it goes a long way if you just wanted to rate the podcast, leave a review, and tell others about our show. In addition, you can let us know what you thought about the episode by emailing us at info@thebiblefornormalpeople.com.
You've just made it through another episode of Faith for Normal People. Don't forget you can catch our other show, The Bible for Normal People, in the same feed wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People team.
I think the, I totally just lost my train of thought, so I have no idea where I was going with that. But yeah, it was a good thought. It was a great thought. It was the best thought.